If you ache for truth, goodness, and beauty, if you're hungry for a Christianity with substance and strength, if you long for a faith that's big and bold and biblical and all about Jesus Christ, if you're inspired by the idea of one church that has spanned 20 centuries, 24 time zones, and two hemispheres, enfolding every race, nation, and language, then you're considering Catholicism.
After the story of Noah, the next couple of chapters in the Bible are dominated by what seem to be long, complicated genealogical tables, recitations of names and places. For modern readers, it's, well, boring. We might acknowledge that there are probably technical details buried here that might be of interest to biblical scholars, but none of it seems very helpful to ordinary people. It doesn't inspire or give us any useful advice about how to live our lives. These genealogies seem like breaks in the story with no action or plot developments. But it's a mistake to dismiss these genealogies and just skip over them, because there's a lot more going on here than we realize from our 21st century vantage point. As we've said from the beginning of this course, we're going to zoom in and out of the Bible story, and it's time to zoom out a bit and widen our perspective. We need to wrap our minds around a big idea that runs from this point, Genesis chapters 10 and 11, all the way to the end of the book of Revelation. This big idea is a big part of the big story. So in this episode, let's step back from the narrative itself to an essential and ongoing theme of the story that the scriptures tell. That theme is the concept of the nations. That's in the plural, with a definite article, the nations. We need to reorient ourselves away from how we use the word nation to how the Bible uses it. It's not just a matter of translating a word more accurately. It's about a different template for history, a different paradigm for how to categorize or classify human communities, a different way of seeing the globe. As the descendants of Noah spread across the world after the flood, they divided into tribes defined by ethnic relationships more than territory. And I choose that word ethnic very deliberately, because that's exactly the right word. Let me explain. There's a Hebrew word used in the Old Testament to describe different people groups, or what we translate as nations. The word is goyim. Now in Hebrew, im is the plural suffix, so goy is a nation, goyim are nations. Now when the Old Testament was translated into Greek before the time of Christ, the word ethnoi was used to render the Greek goyim. In Biblical Greek, oi is the plural suffix. So, in Biblical Greek, ethne is the word for a people group or nation, and ethnoi are people groups or nations. And you can see that that's where we get the English word ethnic, relating to people groups or nations. But again, we have a different template for what constitutes a nation. For us, it's a matter of geography and government. Over the last 700 years or so, we have used the word to mean a nation-state, a territory with defined borders governed by a system of laws and recognized by the international community. We see the globe divided up into these legal entities. So we have France, Russia, the Cayman Islands, whatever. They are nation-states. But the goyim, or the ethnoi, that emerge across the world after Noah, described in Genesis 10 and 11, are more like people groups, tribes, defined by shared genealogy and language. For example, Vietnam is a nation state, but in biblical terms, the Vietnamese would be a nation, regardless of where they live, spread across multiple nation states. In the biblical worldview, the nations are the ethnic linguistic people groups of the world, irrespective of the ever-shifting geographic or political nation-states. Now, why does all of this matter? Because if we're going to really understand the story that the scriptures tell, we have to recognize the premises of that story and enter into its mindset. The biblical story isn't about nation states. It's about the nations, the peoples of the world. And that's one reason why the genealogies of Genesis chapter 10 are too important to ignore. Because these family tree relationships describe how the peoples of the world came about, and how their origins defined their roles in the story of God's redemption and His restoration of the world. Political and geographic nation states are in endless flux, aren't they? This kingdom or empire rises and it overthrows another. The Game of Thrones is played out again and again and again. Borders change, maps are redrawn, dynasties and regimes are replaced. But the peoples, the Jews, the Arabs, the Persians, the Greeks, these goyim, these ethnoi, these nations persist. They have stories, identities, heritages, and cultures. Consider the nation that the biblical story follows, the Hebrews or the Jews. For a time, there was a nation state of Israel, united under three kings, Saul, David, and Solomon. Then Israel was divided into two kingdoms, one in the north and one in the south. Then, one at a time, those two kingdoms were overthrown, the northern kingdom by the Assyrians and the southern kingdom by the Babylonians. The Hebrews or the Jews were scattered throughout the Assyrian and Babylonian empires, and other peoples migrated back into the territory that had once been the nation-state of Israel. Later, the whole Middle East was conquered and ruled by others, the Persians, then the Greeks, then the Romans, and so on down to today. But the Hebrews, the Jews, were and are still a nation in the biblical sense, wherever they are scattered throughout the world. In the biblical sense, the Jewish nation or the Jewish people is bigger than the modern nation state of Israel. And in that context, the big story of the Bible is about uniting the diverse nations of the world. Jesus instructs his apostles to go to all nations, making disciples. Now, we think of that as a command to go to places, but perhaps it's more about reaching across the boundaries of nation states to connect with and speak to ethnic and linguistic groups. Incidentally, this may partially explain the Catholic Church's perspective on issues of migration and immigration. The Church does respect nation states, as well as their borders and laws. But the Church doesn't look out and see a world that is primarily defined by political boundaries. It has deliberately aligned itself more with this biblical perspective. The Church sees the nations, the ethno-linguistic people groups of the world, spread across the ever-shifting boundaries of the political map. And something else about those divisions. Remember that in earlier episodes we saw that at the end of Revelation, the trees of life line the main street of the city of God in the new heaven and the new earth, and that their fruit are for the, quote, healing of the nations. The divisions and conflicts between the peoples of the world, which emerge in Genesis chapter 10, will finally be healed when Christ returns. So, in the biblical narrative, the fracturing of humanity into the nations begins here. So let's take a closer look at these two chapters. Genesis chapter 10 is known as the Table of the Nations. It's a catalog of the nations. The sons and daughters of Noah begin multiplying and spreading out. The divisions begin with family groups, which we might think of as clans, which in turn become tribes. They are all descendants of Noah, but they each develop their own identities, stories, and cultures. The Table of the Nations describes the families of Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the three sons of Noah, and that many children were born to them after the great flood. For example, we read that the descendants of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. The descendants of the fourth son listed, Javan, were Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Rodanim. And their descendants became the seafaring peoples that spread out to various lands, each identified by its own language, clan, and national identity. So, These seafaring peoples populated the coastlines of the Mediterranean. And the name of one of them, Tarshish, comes up again later in the Old Testament. When the prophet Jonah boards a ship and tries to sail as far from Jerusalem as he can possibly get, he heads to a place called Tarshish. Now, obviously, it's not the man listed here, but the people group that descended from Tarshish, which was in the western Mediterranean along the coasts of Spain. We read that Noah's son Ham had a descendant named Cush, who became the ancestor of one Nimrod, who it tells us was the first heroic warrior on earth. Genesis 10 tells us that Nimrod was such a great hunter that his name became synonymous with hunting and fighting, and that Nimrod founded a kingdom in Babylonia, and his descendants became the warrior peoples of Babylon and Assyria, who would someday conquer Israel. We read about the emergence of the Philistine nation that would make war on the Hebrews, and we know this from extra-biblical history, were related to the Carthaginians along the North African coast, would fight an epic war with the Romans for control of the Mediterranean basin. And we read about the peoples that would become the Canaanites, who we'll meet in our next episode. The Hebrews will be locked in an existential struggle with them for the rest of the Bible. And so on and so forth. Each section of the Table of Nations ends with the phrase, "These were the descendants of so-and-so, identified by clan, language, territory, and national identity." And the entire Table of the Nations, chapter 10, ends with these words. "These are the clans that descended from Noah's sons, arranged by nation according to their lines of descent. All the nations of the earth descended from these clans after the great flood." Now, at the beginning of chapter 11, the emergence of languages is explained with the curious story of the Tower of Babel. Just because the story of the Tower of Babel is listed after the Table of Nations does not mean that it actually happened sequentially later in history. Clearly, that's not the case, because chapter 10 mentions linguistic differences between the peoples. The Table of Nations is placed where it is in Genesis because it logically follows from the genealogies of Noah's sons. But at some point, not too far after the flood, the Babel episode took place. So, here's what happened. "Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar." That's an ancient name for the region in Mesopotamia around Babylon. "And they settled there. They said to each other, 'Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly.' They used brick instead of stone, and tar for mortar." In biblical Hebrew, this is a curious expression. The verb "to make bricks" is a variation of the word "brick." So, it literally reads, "they bricked bricks." Now, why does that matter? Well, in biblical Hebrew, it has a sort of staccato sound that emphasizes their frantic busyness. They were bricking bricks as fast as they could, intent on building, taking control of their own destiny, mastering nature, ignoring God. "Then they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth.'" So, once again, mankind is trying to become independent of God. It's a variation on the original temptation of Adam and Eve. They will take control of their own destiny. They will be masters of their own fates. They don't need faith or trust or piety, just bricks and mortar and will and engineering and money and slaves and lots of other components. It turns out that independence from God is harder than it looks. They want to reach for the heavens, in a sense, to take God's place. "But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the people were building. The Lord said, 'If as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them.' So God looks and sees that this thing they are doing, this is a bad thing. It's bad for the same reason that it was bad for Adam and Eve, because it will end badly for them. If mankind unites and reinforces his alienation from God, it will just perpetuate that alienation and make redemption and restoration more painful and expensive. God does have a plan to bring the nations together, but not around a tower they build, but in a city he builds on the resurrection of Christ that restores the Sabbath of Eden. So God breaks up this project, and when he does, the introduction of different languages further divides the peoples. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other. Now, obviously, when no one can understand each other, it's a lot harder to form a city, much less build a tower. Community implies commonality, which is based on shared communication. And when God confuses their language, essentially rendering their tribes not only ethnically distinct, but also linguistically distinct, their unity and the unity of their purpose is shattered. And then, in a bit of irony that's so characteristic of Hebrew storytelling, the narrative is reversed. Just a few short sentences ago, they had said, "Let us build a city and a tower and make a name for ourselves so that we will not be scattered over the face of the earth." But when God confuses their languages, they can no longer speak a common name, and then the very thing they feared comes to pass. So the Lord scattered them from there over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. And that is why it was called Babel, which sounds like the Hebrew word for confused. Because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there, the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So, the very thing that motivated them to build the city and the tower in the first place is exactly what comes about. They are scattered over the face of the earth. And that is how we got the table of the nations. If we look forward to later in the story that the scriptures tell, we'll see that God will reverse the miracle of Babel, bringing the nations together again in three very important ways. First, the Great Commission. Jesus will instruct his apostles to take the gospel to all the nations, making disciples and teaching them to obey everything that he commanded. Now, the gospel becomes then the antidote to the divisions among the nations, and it will spread among them, irrespective of nation states, to form a new human community united in Christ, the church. Second, at Pentecost. The miracle of Pentecost is a deliberate inversion of what happened at Babel. In the second chapter of the book of Acts, we read that members from every nation under heaven were assembled for this annual event at the Old Jerusalem. It tells us that there were Parthians and Medes and Elamites, Mesopotamians, residents of Cappadocia, Pontus, and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya near Cyrene, Cretans and Arabs. And then God reverses the miracle of Babel. Instead of misunderstanding each other, they all understand the gospel that Peter preaches to them. And what's more, they all understand them in their own native languages. God doesn't erase the distinctions between the nations. He bridges them. The final reversal of Babel occurs in the last two chapters of Revelation that we keep foreshadowing in this course because the Bible keeps foreshadowing it. At Babel, mankind tried to raise a city to heaven. In Revelation 21, heaven sends down a city to a resurrected mankind on the restored earth. It is the New Jerusalem, which descends, we are told, beautifully dressed as a bride for her groom. Not a city where mankind will not need God, but a city where God dwells with man who needs him.